Dr. Reese is a native of Texas. He has his wife, Donna, here with him, and their four children, ages 7 and under. And they've been on vacation and are coming back through on the way back to Dayton, Ohio. Dr. Reese was educated at Baylor University, at Southern Seminary, and at Yale University, where he received the PhD degree in 1969. Dr. Reese wrote his dissertation on religion and morality and the thought of Emil Brunner. And Dr. Reese has been very active in the field of medicine and ethics in his writings and in his activities at Wright State University and elsewhere. Dr. Reese is a brilliant man. He and I were classmates at Southern Seminary, and I always look forward to having Bob Reese in a class that I was having for two reasons, both of which were selfish. The first reason is that Bob was so brilliant that we always look forward to the insights that he'd share with the rest of us in the classroom. The second selfish reason was that I don't know anybody who has any handwriting any worse than mine except perhaps Bob Reese, and I always look forward to being in a class with him because I knew the professor would focus on Bob instead of focusing on me. But seriously, he is a very brilliant person. He has written in this field and worked in it, and we look forward now as he comes to speak to us on the subject Christian ethics and human experimentation. After he speaks, we will have an opportunity once again for dialogue and discussion, which we consider to be a very essential part of the conference which we're having these 2 days. Dr. Reese.
After that introduction, I'm reluctant to proceed. I'm afraid that what I will say will dispel the impression that Harry has just created. Seriously, it is very good to be here for this session today and to see some old friends, or maybe I should say some friends of former acquaintance, since none of us want to claim to be old as yet. And I will proceed by presenting some remarks and then hopefully having some discussion which will follow. I think it may be appropriate to respond very quickly, before I even begin that, to one of the questions in the earlier discussion period about the regulation of human experimentation. Dr. McGee's comments that leaves me the burden of answering all those questions is one that I'm not able to bear. But I could make a couple of comments about the nature of some of the regulation which has developed out of concern for human experimentation. And I think the starting point really for that is the Nuremberg trials following World War II and the Nazi atrocities involving human experimentation. As a result of that, a Nuremberg Code was enunciated, and since that time there have been numerous international codes. Unfortunately, however, of course, the enforcement of such codes is really moral rather than legal, Nuremberg being the one example in which case the victors imposed their morality upon the victor, the defeated. But there are some international codes and some codes which carry moral force and professional force, both within our country and worldwide. In terms of legal force, the primary focus now for regulation of human experimentation comes through the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, which is right now in the process of devising further regulations which will govern human experimentation. So much for that comment. If you have further questions, I can refer them to somebody else later. Following the next speaker, following the remarks that I have prepared, I do want us to have some time for both questions and discussion. I like the remark of one speaker who said, if you have any questions after I finish, I will either attempt to answer or evade them. And if I find that I can neither answer nor evade them, then I will attempt to restate the question in such a manner that I can either answer or evade it. Fortunately, this morning, there's another alternative, and that is that I can refer the question to the group for discussion. And so I have a number of tricks that can be used in the discussion period. Let me turn now, then, to some remarks about Christian ethics and human experimentation. Nowhere is the dilemma of modern medicine in its effort to be scientific more clearly apparent than in this area of experimentation involving human subjects. The dilemma is that experimental medicine runs the risk of undermining its very basic intention of relieving human suffering by the very experimental process. The enormous progress and medical advance that has occurred in the last 50 years has required human experimentation. Yet experimentation inevitably involves uncertainty and therefore some element of risk to injury to the patients upon whom the experiments are being performed. The research physician must balance the demands of concern and care for a patient immediately before him with the long-term advance of medical science for the benefit of countless people of contemporary and future generations. I will approach the issue of ethics in human experimentation by describing two well-known and dramatic examples of experimentation in our recent history. Examples which can illustrate the dilemma that I described and can help to define the nature of the problem before us. These cases will serve to highlight several of the ethical issues that confront the researcher and those responsible for public policy. Having employed these cases to define the field of our endeavor, I will then discuss some of the implications of the Christian and biblical tradition in the assessment and conduct of research, applying a Christian perspective to these two cases. Now, the first case which I wish to cite is the Public Health Service's study of untreated syphilis in the male Negro in Macon County, Alabama, more commonly known as the Tuskegee Syphilis Study. The study began in 1932 when approximately 400 black men in rural Alabama became part of a study of the long-term effects, both psychological and medical, of untreated syphilis. They were subjects in this experiment without their knowledge and without their consent. The men were told that they had, quote, bad blood, unquote, for which they were given injections for 25 years. The injections were, in fact, placebos, since this group was a control group to be compared with a group that was receiving genuine treatment. Even in the early years of the study, it became apparent that the health of the control group in virtually every category of medical category was significantly poorer in the control group than in the group receiving therapy. Even when the earlier drugs used in treating syphilis were superseded by a superior drug, penicillin, which became available in the 1940s, even then no effort was made until 1966 to stop the experiment and provide available therapy to the survivors. And it was not until public attention was focused on the study by a series of articles by the Associated Press in 1972 that the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare initiated an investigation that resulted in the termination of the experiment. Okay, the second example now is of a very different sort, and I refer now not to a particular experiment, but to the general area of heart transplant surgery. On December 3rd, 1967, the world was astonished by the announcement that Dr. Christian Barnard had performed the first transplant of a human heart into the body of another human being. Those familiar with the world of medicine, however, were neither surprised nor amazed. Prior animal work and successive stages of clinical investigation presaged this first transplant. The question was not whether such experimental surgery would be accomplished, but simply how soon and by whom. The first patient died 18 days later. But long-term survival was achieved with Dr. Barnard's second transplant on Philip Bleiberg a month later. Long-term means, in this case, a year and a half. The year 1968, then, was heralded by the media as the year of the heart transplant. It marked a symbolic victory involving the most culturally significant organ in the human body. But by the year's end, the evidence was already beginning to contradict the early expressions of enthusiasm. It was becoming obvious that the technical success of the surgery was not matched by equal success in understanding and controlling the mechanism of tissue rejection. Regrettably, the old quip was all too accurate in this case. The surgery was a success. Unfortunately, the patient died. November 1968 was the peak month for transplants. Ironically, it was in that same month that a decision was reached which first signaled the rapid and radical decline of cardiac transplants. On November 30th, the Montreal Heart Institute decided upon a moratorium on heart transplants to await further investigation into the failure of so many transplant procedures. By the time the moratorium was publicly announced 2 months later, only 39 out of 108 heart transplant recipients were still alive. Although many of the world's transplant surgeons objected to the Montreal moratorium, in fact, a dramatic slowdown of transplants occurred worldwide, such that it amounted to a virtual, partial, undeclared moratorium. Patients died as a result of one of their many rejection episodes or because of infection, which was permitted because large doses of immunosuppressive drugs were prescribed to prevent rejection, which therefore allowed infection to occur. Further, the postmortem analysis of Philip Blyberg's death in August of 69 pointed to yet another problem in transplant surgery, namely the development of coronary artery disease in the recipient's new heart. Heart transplants and supporting research continued, but a chastened, less ebullient group of transplanters now proved more cautious and moved at a slower pace and with less confidence of immediate victory. Even when teams achieved a measure of success with survivors, they were not able to identify with certainty the factors that led to success. In 1969, then, the cardiac transplant experiment had reached a temporary dead end. Now, a comparison of these two cases will help to delineate many of the features of experimentation involving human subjects and suggest what kinds of issues call for ethical analysis. First, both of these are cases of experimentation rather than pure observational research. There are broader and narrower ways of defining experimentation, but I will be using the term to describe a situation in which the researcher does something deliberately that is intended to affect the outcome of events. The experimenter introduces an element of control into his study which does not characterize observational research. Now, clearly, a heart transplant involves such intervention. I would argue that the researchers in the Tuskegee study were also engaged in experimentation. They were not merely observing the men in Macon County. By refraining from providing a therapy which was indicated, they were doing something different from what they would have done in the absence of the research. Both control groups and experimental groups are part of an experimental design. Because the experimenter takes an active role in changing the course of events, his ethical burden is probably greater than in research which merely involves observation alone. Second, we can observe that both of these experiments involve biomedical research, in contrast to behavioral research on the one hand or environmental research on the other. Behavioral research is not concerned with biological illness and health, but with the way in which people respond, cope, perceive, and react psychologically and behaviorally. Environmental research seeks to determine the effects of a particular process on the general population, and indeed upon the entire ecosystem. For example, the testing for the effects of new pesticides or new food additives. The differences in the scope and purpose of these several kinds of human research and the differences in methodology of the studies suggest that norms may differ for each of the different procedures. My remarks today then will focus on biomedical research and experimentation. A third point. We should note that these experiments contrast significantly with normal medical practice. Although in some sense every office visit by a patient involves an experiment, several factors clearly distinguish the daily practice of medicine from experimental medicine. The lack of control mechanisms, the absence of research design, and most particularly the differences in the intentions and motivations of the practicing physician distinguishes his activity from that of the research physician. Again, I would argue that the moral risk increases as one moves from standard therapies where risks are at least calculable to experimentations where risks are essentially unknown and incalculable. The fourth, another similarity in these two cases is that neither involves the use of healthy subjects. It is frequently easier to justify experimentation with those who already have the disease or condition being researched than to introduce risk to those who were perfectly healthy before the experiment began. Fifth, a contrast between these two cases also illustrates one of the important issues in human experimentation, that is, the contrast between therapeutic and non-therapeutic experimentation. The heart transplant is clearly intended to be a benefit to the patient himself. Its goal is the prolongation of life for that individual. The Tuskegee experiment clearly was not intended to offer any benefit to the subjects in the control group. It is generally easier, I would suggest, to justify experimentation that potentially will benefit the subject than experimentation that does not. Before now I examine these cases from the perspective of a Christian ethic, some general remarks about Christian ethics are necessary. It will be apparent in most of what follows that I am as concerned with methodological questions in Christian ethics as I am with the content of human experimentation itself. Now, time does not permit, of course, an elaborate development, delineation, and the careful justification of the approach to Christian ethics that I will be taking. And I must content myself with outlining some of the essential elements of a Christian ethic as I would develop it, if time permitted. My first point would be that the data for Christian ethical reflection is the biblical foundation, the history of the Christian tradition in theology and practice, and current affairs. Although the Bible is the touchstone, its message is inevitably filtered through the lens of some particular theological perspective, which is always tinted, however subtly. Particularly when it comes to issues like human experimentation, the problem is so far removed from anything that was conceived by the biblical writers that the Bible cannot be expected to speak directly to the issue, but can only speak indirectly through certain biblically based moral principles and theological concepts of the nature of human existence and human dignity. As a corollary, I would add that there is no the Christian ethic. There are numerous ethics that claim the Christian banner, and though I find some of them more illuminating and more in accord with my understanding of Christian faith than others, I would not be so presumptuous as to excommunicate any one of them. None can be dismissed because each becomes one bit of data for the continuing task of Christian ethical reflection. Christian ethics, then, is a theological enterprise which involves, if I may paraphrase Karl Barth, standing with the Bible and the record of the history of the Christian tradition in the one hand and the newspaper in the other. The second general statement about Christian ethics concerns the question whether Christian faith has implications for the content of moral decision in such areas as human experimentation, or whether it merely provides the motivation for doing what is determined to be right on other grounds. That is, does Christian faith help us decide what to do, or does it merely inspire us to do what is right? Now, lest this be thought a frivolous question with an obvious answer, I would point out that a sizable portion of the Christian tradition operates on the assumption that much of morality is based upon a common moral sense that is available to all men of goodwill, regardless of religious persuasion. The doctrine of natural law, which has been so prominent in Christian history, especially in the Catholic tradition, and the concept of the orders of creation in Luther and Calvin and their Protestant heirs, place great emphasis upon the moral insight available to Christian and non-Christian alike on the basis of their purely rational capacities. I must confess that I find the concept of natural law, broadly understood, quite useful in accounting for the obvious moral quality of the lives of many who disclaim the name Christian. It is also significant in my own ethical reflection. But as I shall attempt to show shortly, I believe that there are principles and perspectives within the Christian tradition that point the direction of proper human action. I believe that Christian faith implies something about the content of human action. It does not simply provide motivation. At the same time, however, I am not concerned to insist upon the distinctiveness of Christian ethics at the practical level of decision-making. That is, I am neither surprised nor troubled if the Christian and the humanist arrive at identical conclusions in a particular case. What finally separates Christian ethics from other ethics is that the Christian ultimately appeals to an understanding of the world and human value illuminated by the figure of Jesus Christ, and that may or may not make a difference in a particular concrete case. This leads to a third question. In addressing such a topic as Christian ethics and human experimentation, are we concerned to speak solely to the Christian scientist, that's a small s, about the proper conduct of his research, or are we talking about the needs for public policy as well? My answer is both. I do not wish to underestimate the importance of the conscientiousness of the researcher, but for a number of reasons, I do not think we can afford any longer to leave the oversight of human experimentation solely in the hands of the researcher, as the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare has recognized. This is one of the areas in which morality needs to be firmly institutionalized. On the other hand, I am reluctant to impose upon society at large, particularly so in a pluralistic society, values which are distinctively religious. Here I return to the comments I made a bit earlier about natural, rational morality. As a general rule, I, as a Christian ethicist, would not propose that Christian norms be applied as a basis for public policy unless they can be justified on other grounds as well, in accordance with values that are part of the general public consensus. Now, with those general statements regarding my approach to Christian ethics, I shall now move to discuss some of the concepts of a Christian ethic which have applicability to human experimentation, and I will attempt to demonstrate how they may illuminate the issues raised by the two cases with which I began. First, I will emphasize the relational nature of Christian ethics. Christian ethics is not, in the first instance, a set of rules or laws, nor even a calculus for the impersonal calculation of competing values. Rather, Christian ethics is first of all concerned with the right ordering of human relationships. Many of the key words of Christianity speak of relationships. Relationships between man and God and man and man. Love, reconciliation, forgiveness, faith, fellowship, community. Rules, laws, institutions, calculations, all these are important insofar as they serve to promote and defend the order of human relationships. Therefore, part of the ethical analysis of human experimentation is the consideration of the network of human interactions which surround the experimental setting. Part of the relational aspect of human social existence can be described in terms of role relationships. Christian thought has long recognized that different roles involve different kinds of responsibility. The New Testament and the history of the Christian Church emphasizes that particular offices, both religious and secular, carry with them particular kinds of responsibilities. People are assigned obligations by virtue of their social role. Obviously, not all social roles are morally justified, and there are certainly limits to the obligations one assumes in any role. But the acceptance of a particular role does place one under a moral burden that would not be his in the absence of such a role. The physician in these two cases have undertaken particular responsibilities by virtue of their role as researcher. The role is a justifiable one, within proper limits, because medical research holds promise for human welfare. And although we probably would not hold any individual morally obligated to become a researcher, once the role has been accepted, we would probably hold the scientist morally deficient if he did not strive diligently to design and execute research that would promote human knowledge and serve human health. There is the responsibility of the researcher to do good research. But the obligation to do research is qualified in a variety of ways by other role relations. The relation with a team of researchers, the opinions of the team about their own values and their own opinions, which must be taken into account. The relationship with a funding agency, which has its own set of expectations, and the relationship with the subjects, who have placed confidence and trust in the investigator. Many researchers feel their dual and often conflicting responsibilities quite keenly as they endeavor to work as investigators dedicated to advancing human knowledge and simultaneously to act responsibly in protecting the health and well-being of the subjects. This conflict was apparently particularly pronounced for some members of heart transplant teams. It was, in fact, this concern for patients expressed particularly by the non-surgeons on the team that led to the moratorium announced by the Montreal Heart Institute. Indeed, the general slowdown in heart transplants seemed to be in large measure an expression of genuine concern for the well-being of the patients. By contrast, it is difficult to conceive of any way in which the Tuskegee study can be seen either as arising out of genuine human interpersonal relationships or as promoting such relationships. The role of researcher seems to have become so dominant that it obliterated all other obligations save the single duty to search for knowledge. Now, this leads me to suggest another theme from the Christian tradition, which is especially significant in the context of human experimentation. I refer to the important concept of sin and the related idea that all human action stands under divine judgment. This sense of sin should make the individual investigator wary of even his good intentions, since great evil is often done in the name of a greater good. In neither of these experiments do we have reason to think that harm to the subjects was the intention of the experimenter. If harm occurred, it was an unintended byproduct. But a byproduct so predictable in the Tuskegee case that the investigators can hardly be excused for their overzealous pursuit of knowledge. The pursuit of good often blinds us to the costs of achieving that good. It is partly because of the distortion of vision that accompanies deep commitment to a project that I have argued that we cannot trust the good intentions of researchers themselves to see their work objectively and to provide adequate protection for human subjects. Social control of experimentation is necessary. A second implication of the Christian notion of sin and finitude is the relativity of all human value and all human truth as it stands under the judgment of God. This in turn points to the virtue of humility. The idea of humility is related in a curious way to the ethic of scientific endeavor. The ethic of science holds that the obligation of the scientist is to search for truth and to share his knowledge freely with his colleagues so that the general search for knowledge can be promoted. Personal competition, professional arrogance, and deceptive reporting are among the chief vices of the ethic of science, vices which are exhibited all too often in the actual practice of scientific research of all types. The mix of devotion to one's task with personal ambition and desire for fame is especially obvious in the case of the experimental heart surgery. And the attention of the media to this dramatic experimental venture certainly intensified the competitive nature of the whole episode. To suggest some other elements of the Christian faith that can help illuminate our subject today, I would like to borrow a page from Ernst Troeltsch, elaborating upon his efforts to uncover the basic principles that govern the social teachings of the Christian churches. Troeltsch's essential conclusion is that there is no explicit, overt, and intentional social teaching in the original Christian message. Troeltsch argues that Christ called for individual disciples, not for the transformation of society. However, there are some latent principles with social import in the original Christian gospel, which began to be applied first within the church and were eventually extended analogically to apply to the larger society as well. Troeltsch concluded that the primitive Christian gospel contained the seeds of four fundamental social values: individualism, universalism, equality, and freedom. Now, a Troeltsian style of argument would go something like this: God loves each individual and accords him a dignity independent of his achievement. People are valuable not on the basis of any inherent or acquired characteristics, but because they are given value by God, because they are loved by God. Social distinctions are leveled within the church, since all earthly distinctions are swallowed up in divine love and power. There is neither Jew nor Greek, there is neither bond nor free, there is neither male nor female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus. Now, this principle was first applied only within the church, and admittedly, unevenly even there. Eventually, however, the ideas of dignity of the individual and the equality of all, these ideas were eventually translated into goals for the whole social order. And Troeltsch's study is an attempt to show how that indeed happened. One of the relevant principles for biomedical ethical research One of the relevant principles for biomedical research that follows from this dedication to the individual welfare of a human being is the promotion and maintenance of individual health and the minimizing of suffering, pain, and death. This certainly, in Troeltsch's sense, is to be balanced with the understanding of the importance of the doctrine of equality as a religious principle later applied to the social order. A corresponding principle to this notion of individual dignity and equality in the Trolltian argument is the principle of fellowship or community. All who share a common calling by God are related to one another by bonds which require concern for the body of believers. Those who acknowledge God as Father must see that all his children are their brothers. And again, this notion of fellowship originally applied only to the community of believers. But the universal implications deriving from the universality of God's love ultimately gave impetus to the enunciation of a Christian social ethic. These twin principles, respect for the welfare and dignity of the individual and a dedication to the general welfare, continue as sometimes complementary, sometimes conflicting principles in Christian ethics. The attempt to balance these two principles in their application to human experimentation leads quite naturally into the discussion of risk-benefit ratios. In the design of an experiment, the perceived risk to the individual human subject must be significantly outweighed by the anticipated benefit to the individual or to society. No experiment could be justified unless it was judged to meet this test, no matter how willing the subjects, even if the subject of the experiment was the investigator himself. Moreover, the experiment should be canceled whenever it becomes obvious that the projected risk-benefit ratio in fact underestimated significantly the potential harm to the subjects. Now, available evidence suggests that the Tuskegee syphilis study failed to meet this test. Apparently, when the study was begun in 1932, no one had any clear idea about what important knowledge the study was likely to produce that could justify withholding therapy from 400 men. However, it must be acknowledged that at that early stage, the available therapy was less impressive than later treatments, so that the risk-benefit ratio at the outset was less disproportionate than it would be later. Within 4 years, however, it was obvious that the health of the control group was significantly poorer than in the experimental group. Yet no attempt was made to halt the study. By the 1950s, with penicillin as an established therapy, the fact that therapy was withheld in the absence of any obvious and overwhelming social benefit is nothing short of scandalous. By contrast, in the case of heart transplants, the risk-benefit ratio seemed much more favorable for the experiment. Since most candidates for a transplant are in a terminal condition, the primary risk is prolonged suffering and psychological strain, since death usually seems imminent in the absence of some such radical measure. Now, whether heart transplant experimentation promised sufficient social benefit to warrant the social costs in terms of the allocation of medical resources, which Dr. McGee referred to earlier, is quite another question. But in terms of benefit to the patient, at least there is a closer balance of the benefit to the patient versus the risk to the patient. At the outset, at any rate. In addition, however, to weighing the risk-benefit ratios, a second principle defends the dignity of the individual, namely, the principle that no subject should be used in an experiment without his voluntary, informed consent. The principle is obviously a difficult one to apply, as evidenced by the volume of literature devoted to the subject. Pressure, enticement, coercion, these make voluntary consent difficult. The subject's ignorance of technical medical knowledge and various forms of mental incompetence hinder informed consent. Experiments in which deception or ignorance is required as a condition of the experiment, these kinds of problems are particularly problematic for informed consent. Yet the importance of the principle remains as a manifestation of respect for individual rights. And it is reinforced in Christian ethics by the argument that one of the basic Christian values is voluntarism or freedom. Again, referring to Trelch, as each individual has ultimate responsibility for determining his own spiritual destiny, deciding for himself whether to accept or to reject the Christian message, so analogously, Christians came to argue that each individual should exercise as much control over his own physical destiny as is consistent with the general welfare. Again, the Tuskegee study contravenes the principle of informed consent blatantly. The men were not even informed that they were part of an experiment. The problem with informed consent in the heart transplant case is quite different. Many of the heart transplant recipients were very well informed. Some of them were taken in almost as partners in the experiment. The question here is whether someone in a situation of desperate illness can offer genuinely voluntary consent. Illness itself is coercive. One of the most serious difficulties of informed consent in cases of this sort is being sure that what is being said is both heard and understood and accepted by the patient. Seriously ill patients so often grasp for any hope. They grasp so much for any hope that they often refuse to acknowledge the grave risks that a new experimental procedure may entail. Again, referring to the relational kind of notion of Christian ethics that I alluded to earlier, I would suggest that it is important for truth-telling, for accurate communication, not merely to be concerned with what one says, but with how that is understood and accepted by the person to whom it is said. Another somewhat related issue has to do with discrimination in the selection of subjects for research. Certain populations present particularly difficult problems: prisoners, children, the mentally retarded, the fetus. If there is anything clear about the life and teachings of Jesus, it is that he was particularly concerned with those who were on the margins of society, the outcast, the weak, the powerless, the oppressed. Yet there is a tendency for such people to bear a disproportionate share of the burden of human experimentation in this country. One can hardly avoid the suspicion, for example, that there was discrimination on the basis of race in the Tuskegee study. And it is not unlikely that the presumed immorality associated with their disease may have further dampened the normal compassion which these patients would have received. A more justifiable principle for the selection of human subjects would be that those who stand to benefit the most from medical research, namely those who have the easiest access to quality health care, ought to be the preferred subjects, the exact reverse of much contemporary practice. Let me now conclude by outlining briefly three other ways in which Christian ethics may contribute to the analysis of the ethics of human experimentation. First, although Christian thought has contributed historically to the respect for life, Christians do not hold life to be the ultimate value. The language of some of the transplant surgeons suggests that they were engaged in a pitched battle with an absolute evil, death, and that to prolong life by even a single day by radical experimental surgery is worth every effort. But for the Christian who believes in the final sovereignty of God over even death itself, the quality of life and its meaningfulness in terms of human relationships is the more important factor, and not just the length of life. Second, the Christian virtue of giving up oneself for the welfare of others, even of self-sacrifice, suggests that volunteering as a subject in an experiment may be an act of Christian charity, though we probably would not call it a Christian obligation. Much attention has been focused on procedures and policies to protect volunteer subjects, and rightly so, especially with several studies which have demonstrated that a high percentage of volunteers appear to be mentally and emotionally disturbed. Much less attention has been given to the morally commendable desire of many stable individuals to give a gift of life through the cautious and prudent use of their own bodies as subjects in important and sometimes risky experimentation. Among these heroes are many investigators who become subjects in their own experimentation. Finally, let me return to the concern for individual welfare within the social context. I would suggest that as Christians, we ought to be concerned not only for the individual subjects of experiments themselves, but for the effects upon the total social fabric. Public knowledge that physicians in our society can and have experimented on men like those in Tuskegee, without their knowledge and consent, and to their detriment, diminishes, however slightly, the confidence which is accorded the medical profession, and reduces the sense of security of individuals who may now wonder whether they too may someday become unwitting subjects for a dangerous experiment. Or, focusing too much public attention on an experimental procedure like heart transplants before major difficulties have been resolved raises expectations in the minds of many individuals which are bound to be frustrated. The point is that the effects, for good or ill, of a particular experiment reach far beyond the medical benefits or injury to particular subjects. It affects the ethos of the research and medical community and the fragile structure of the social order itself. Biomedical research has been a great boon to health in our society. It has raised our expectations for even further revolutionary advances. At the same time, we do not need the example of experimentation in Nazi Germany to remind us of the sacrifice of individuals in the name of science. We have quite enough examples of exploitation and abuse in our own society to warn us of the dangers of creating involuntary martyrs for the sake of science. The enunciation of almost 40 codes governing human experimentation, the growing public concern for the conditions of human experimentation, and the developing system of regulation by HEW all indicate a growing consensus, and they provide mechanisms for minimizing the abuse of human subjects in research. Obviously, such restrictions make the job of the researcher more difficult. Hopefully, public discussions such as this one today will assist in the development of a balanced social perspective, which will recognize the need for further improved mechanisms to guard against the misuse of human subjects, but which will also appreciate the social value of biomedical research and the need for volunteers who will give of themselves for the betterment of mankind.